Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon with an open phone line for you to call if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or if you have a different view from that of the host you'd like to bring up. I will say the lines are usually open, but they're full right now, but there will be lines opening up in the course of the next hour. And if you're interested in joining us, you can't call right now because you get a busy signal, but have this number ready. Call back in a little while and you may find a line has opened up. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And I want to remind our listeners in Arizona that next Tuesday night I will be speaking in the Phoenix area, in Buckeye, actually. So that's Tuesday night. And then the following night, I'm speaking in Tucson. And if you're interested in any of those gatherings, either of them, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Look under announcements, and you'll see the time and place of those gatherings. Love to see you there. That's next Tuesday night in the Phoenix area, really Buckeye. And Wednesday night in Tucson. Now, a few days later, as we approach the weekend next weekend, I'll be in Texas, and I'll be speaking in the San Antonio area next weekend in Spring Branch, Texas. Then later on in the week, I'll be in Houston. I'll be speaking in Houston and also in Dallas before the end of the week. So over the next week or so, probably the next couple weeks, I'll be in Arizona and in Texas. After that, I'm going further east to Arkansas and Missouri and Illinois and Indiana, and I'll be speaking in those places too. So if you live in any of those areas and are interested in joining us, go to thenarrowpath.com, click the tab that says Announcements, and you'll find that itinerary there, times and places. Love to meet some of you if I have not before, and I'm looking forward to seeing, again, people that I have met before. Let's talk to Bob from Bellevue, Washington. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon to you. I have a question and a comment. My question has to do with the disciples named James, who are called apostles. James, son of Zebedee, and then James, of son of Alphaeus, if that's pronounced right. But anyway, there's another James in there called James the Less, who is mentioned always with his mother, wife of Clopas. And she and James the Less were, according to Mark, or Matthew anyway, one of them, at the cross when Jesus was crucified. My question seems to be, what is James the apostle, son of Alphaeus, regarded as the same as James the Less? And if so, then in looking at church history writings, two in particular, Eusebius says of a fellow named Hegesippus, who died in 180 A.D., says that Clopas, who was married to the sister of Mary, the mother of our Lord, was a brother of Joseph, making Mary of Clopas a sister-in-law to Mary, mother of Jesus, and her kids would be cousins. And they're mentioned as James, Joseph, Simon, Jude, and Adelphius. But it doesn't seem to jive with other instances. I know that Catholics will say that Joseph had other children, perhaps older or older
from
than
a previous marriage.
Yeah, from a previous marriage, and of course that there's nothing biblical in that. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on this, because it does say that James and Jovis, Joseph, Simon, Jude, and sister or sisters, they use the term Greek word for brother, not cousin. And
right.
I'm just wondering what your thought was on that.
Well, first of all, there's a lot of confusion about some of the characters about whom very little is said. Some of them, we only know them from their names appearing in various lists, and some of them have the same names as other people, which is very common. We know this from secular research that there were a very large number of men in the days of Jesus in Palestine, for example, named Simon. Simon, in fact, was the most common name among men in that generation. And we see that there's a lot of Simons in the New Testament. We also know of a lot of Simons that are not in the New Testament from that same period. James was also a very common name. Of course, it's the form of the word Jacob. And Jacob was a very important person. So it's not surprising there were a lot of Jameses, a lot of Simons, and some other names too. Jude or Judas in the Greek form. There were quite a few Judes. In fact, there were two Judes among the apostles, among the 12. There were two Jameses, and there were two Simons. So even among the 12, there were two that were named Simon, there were two that named Jude, and there were two that were named James. Now, James the son of Alphaeus is generally understood to be the same as James the Less. Now, there may be others who have other theories, and perhaps there's room for other theories because we have very little data on him, but it would appear, for example, we believe that Thaddeus was also named Lebbeus because of certain lists. And he was also called Judas, not Iscariot. So we've got, you know, three different names in the lists for the same guy. At least it's believed to be the same guy. Likewise, Bartholomew is on the list, but he's thought to be the same as Nathaniel, who's mentioned in John, though not mentioned to be one of the 12. So guys had different names. Matthew is also called Levi in the narrative. So it gets very confusing when, first of all, there's a number of people with the same name, and then there's sometimes a number of names of the same person. But from studying out the Gospels, I follow pretty much the main line on this, that James the Less is the same as the James, the son of Alphaeus. Now, he may have been a first cousin of Jesus. We know that the sons of Zebedee were. The sons of Zebedee, their mother was a sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus. So we know that James and John, the sons of Zebedee, they were first cousins of Jesus. And then James the Less may also have been as well. It's hard to sort all those things out. But your question seems to be about the Roman Catholic idea that these people who are said in the New Testament to be called the brothers of Jesus are really cousins of Jesus, or maybe half-brothers. If the Catholic Church has suggested more than one thing. One is that Joseph did have other children from a marriage that had ended in the death of his wife. And so when he married Mary, there were these older sons already in the family before Jesus was even born. That's not impossible, but there's nothing in the Bible to support it. Likewise, Roman Catholics have sometimes had a different theory, and that is that the word brothers, adelphi, in the Greek, is a generic term for relatives. And that can be. In the Bible, sometimes people who are not siblings are called brothers because they are close relatives, and the word brother is used in a non-literal way. For example, when Abraham and Lot were having problems among themselves in, I think it's the 13th chapter of Genesis. It says, Abraham said to Lot, "Let's not have any striving between you and me or our herdsmen because we're brothers." Well, they weren't brothers. Abraham was his uncle, but they were relatives. And so the word brothers sometimes means relatives. So Roman Catholics will say sometimes that when it talks about Jesus' brothers and his sisters, that this is referring to simply relations, not siblings. While that is not impossible, we don't know of any specific case elsewhere where first cousins are called brothers in the Bible. And there was another word in the Greek language for cousins. In fact, Barnabas was apparently the cousin of Mark and is referred to as such. So there are other more specific names for more specific designations of relationship besides the generic for brothers. So what I'd say is there's a possibility that brothers could be used in order to suggest relatives of some other close kinship that are not siblings. But it'd be the unusual use in the New Testament. We don't know of any other case like that. So I think the simplest thing would be to say that these brothers were actually half-brothers of Jesus, in that Mary and Joseph had more children after Jesus was born. Jesus is referred to as Mary's firstborn. In Luke chapter 2, he is referred to as her firstborn. And in the last verse of Matthew chapter 1, Jesus is referred to as her firstborn in some manuscripts. Some manuscripts do not have the word firstborn in the last verse of Matthew chapter 1, but some do. But at least in Luke, he is referred to as Mary's firstborn. So now some would say, well, that's not that doesn't mean she had other children, because firstborn was a kind of a privileged title and so forth in a family. And it spoke of primogeniture and authority over the other children and so forth, whether they were other children or not. The firstborn was the heir. And so they would say calling Jesus the firstborn doesn't mean there were others. But I think that's a pretty weak argument. I think that if he was the only child Mary ever had, there'd be no real reason to refer to him as her firstborn in those places. So I think, and it does say in the end of Matthew chapter 1, that Joseph did not have sexual relations with Mary until she had brought forth her son, Jesus. So it suggests that afterward they had normal relations, and there's no reason they couldn't have children together. So that'd be my answer to those issues. All right, let's talk to Paul from Buena Vista, Colorado. Paul, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just heard yesterday, are you familiar with Dave Hocking out of California?
Sure, yeah.
Because he's a dispensationalist, and I listen to him on a daily basis.
Uh-huh.
And so my question, you know, I kind of, what I'm doing is just kind of gathering information.
Okay.
Because I've never really studied this out completely. Don't really always have that much time on my hands. But I did.
So what is the subject? Yeah.
The subject is amillennialism.
Okay.
Because the comment was made on his program by himself today that there are a lot of guys that are now switching over to being amillennials rather than dispensationalists or pre-tribbers because of what's going on in the world right now. And I thought that was quite a statement. I was like, whoa.
Wait. Oh, you mean he's saying there's a lot of people becoming post-tribulationists rather than pre-tribulationists. Is that what he's saying?
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you
okay.
for care.
Okay, because amillennial, amillennial is not the same thing as that. I mean, while it is true and amillennials will be post-trib, probably most people who describe themselves as post-tribulationists will be still premillennial. You know, when dispensationalists tell us that premillennialism, or they would even say dispensationalism, was the view of the early church, they're wrong in saying that it was the view of that dispensationalism was, but they are correct that many of the early church fathers were premillennial. They just weren't dispensationalists. And one of the biggest differences between the two is dispensationalists, who are premillennial, also believe in a pre-trib rapture. But the historic premillennialists, some of the church fathers, they believed in a future millennium, but not in a pre-trib rapture. So usually if someone is called post-trib, it's distinguishing their view of the rapture, not of the millennium. So I don't know what he said. I don't know if he used the word amillennialist or not. But it sounds to me that whether he did or not, he's saying that some people who used to be pre-trib are now post-trib because of things that are going on right now, I assume that means that they think maybe we're in the tribulation. I don't believe is the case. I don't believe. Well, if we were coming into it, you could still be pre-trib, you know. I mean, pre-trib just says that the rapture will take place and take the church out before the tribulation begins. If we haven't come into it yet, then I guess their view hasn't been proven wrong yet. And a pre-tribber could believe that the tribulation is coming on and that it will be raptured very soon. I'm not pre-trib, of course. I'm not even premillennial, but that would be a strange decision to make. I mean, if I had biblical grounds for being pre-trib, then nothing that's happening in the world today would change my mind, because frankly, I don't change my mind on theology by worldly circumstances, but rather by what the Bible says. Now, if a pre-tribber actually studied the Bible somewhat more thoroughly and decided that the Bible does not teach a pre-trib rapture, then they might come to the conclusion that the tribulation is upon us and that we'll be going through it. To my mind, it's interesting if he's right that anyone who was pre-trib would change their mind because it looks like the tribulation's coming. Because you shouldn't be pre-trib unless you think that's what the Bible teaches. And if you think that's what the Bible teaches, then none of the current events in the world should change what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches what it teaches. So I had a feeling saying there's a lot of pre-tribbers who never had a good biblical reason for being pre-trib.
Steve, your mind is like a steel trap. It's a compliment. I'm fascinated by your ability to deduce time frames, scenarios. I mean, even in the discussion you just had about the name, you know, James and the name of that guy, I was listening to it going, this guy is so into details, I can't hardly hang with you. But by the same
token, I probably bore a lot of people with that, I'm sure.
Well, yes and no. But see, my problem is when you're talking and your mind is moving so fast that mine can't keep up. I mean, I had a stroke about 3 years ago, and I'm 64 years old, and I'm doing the best I can to follow what you're saying. And so what I'm getting is, let me see if I got this right. There's a difference between being all-millennial and pre-tribulation.
Well, let me make it as clear as I can. There's three views
a
about
that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, there's three views about the millennium. One is premillennialism. This is the view that Jesus will come back before the millennium. So they believe
that's not what you are.
That's not what I am anymore. I was like so many other people before I examined the Bible.
Okay, that's clear. Go ahead.
So let me go forward here. There are people who believe Jesus will come back before the millennium, and therefore he'll come up and establish the millennial kingdom. That's premillennialism. They believe in a premillennial return of Christ. There's also postmillennialists, and they believe that Jesus will come back after the millennium. They believe there will be 1,000 years of peace and justice and righteousness on earth established through the power of the gospel prevailing, and Jesus will not come back until the end of that. That's postmillennialism. So they believe in a postmillennial or after the millennium return of Christ. Amillennialism is the view that the whole idea of a 1,000-year reign is missing the point, that Revelation 20, which speaks of that 1,000 years, is using symbolic language, and that it represents the long period, not 1,000 year literally, but a very long period between the first and second coming of Christ, so that we're actually living in that period of time. That's the amillennial view. And that was the view of the church through almost all of history. And in the first few centuries, there were some premillennialists, but not dispensationalists. See, dispensationalism is a form of premillennialism. Certainly dispensationalists believe Jesus will come back and establish a millennial kingdom. But dispensationalism arose in around the 1830s, and it added something that was never in premillennialism before, and that was the pre-trib rapture, that the church would leave here 7 years before the end, and the tribulation will fill that gap. So the idea of a pre-trib rapture is strictly dispensationalism, and it's a form of premillennialism, because both dispensationalists and other premillennialists believe there will be a millennial kingdom after Jesus comes back. But the historic premillennialists, that is the ones who believed in a future millennium in the early church, did not believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. So dispensational premillennialism is distinguished from historic premillennialism. And so that's my, I guess, my short course on the terminology of the millennium. I'm amillennial, but I don't have time to go into this more because I have so many callers waiting. You do say that... you have a hard time following the speed I'm talking. I don't blame you. I do too. Sometimes I get ahead of myself. But, I speak fast because there's so many calls waiting and because it takes a long time to say it. But I will say this. You can always go back and hear it again. You can either go back to our website or our app, which is thenarrowpath.com, where all the programs are archived and you can listen to it and you can slow it down. Or there's... another website called Matthew713.com, which actually you can find the actual call, your call. If you look up probably the subject pre-trib or something like that, you can actually listen to your call. And you can listen to it over and over again, and it's all free, of course. So if I go by it too fast the first time, you can go by it a little, after the program and hear it as slowly as you might need to. I appreciate your call, brother. Let's talk to Tom from Tacoma, Washington. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. We're going to be studying in a Bible study next Sunday, the 23rd chapter of Isaiah. And everything goes okay until the last two verses. Isaiah had prophesied against Tyre, as you know, and for 70 years they were going to be sort of forgotten. And in verse 17, according to the American Standard Version of the Bible, it says that at the end of 70 years, the Lord will restore Tyre, and she will go back into business, prostituting herself with the kingdoms of the world throughout the earth. And then, but what I'm stumped on is the prostituting, whether this is just kind of a bad translation, because in verse, the last verse, it says, but her profits and wages will be dedicated to the Lord. They will not be stored or saved, for the profit will go to those who live in the Lord's presence to provide with them with ample food and sacred clothing. And it seems like there's something missing between the two verses. And I've gone back and on YouTube listened to some sermons, and the pastors who did these sermons were saying that Tyre fell back into sin, didn't learn their lesson during the 70 years. But to me, it sounds like the prostitute herself primarily is trying to sell herself, trying to say hustle to get business from the other countries. And so that's my question is, and I know Isaiah used poetry in his prophecies and stuff, and I just wonder if that's prostituting herself is actually, she was actually sinning, because the very next verse says she was doing the will of God and said God had restored her.
Well, yeah, this is talking about a judgment coming upon Tyre. It's either referring to the judgment when, you know, Babylon came and conquered that whole land, and then 70 years later, Babylon was conquered by the Persians, and so all the captives were released. That's how Israel became, or Judah became a nation again, after 70 years, God brought them back from Babylon. Or this could even be talking about an earlier judgment on Tyre, which was of Sennacherib, who is the Assyrian, over a century earlier than the Babylonian exile. He attacked, I don't really know. I don't know the exact years when Tyre was attacked, but it could be that it's talking about a 70-year period where they may have suffered under the Assyrians. Whenever I see 70 years in this kind of context, I usually think of it as the Babylonian exile, and it could well be. When they came back from Babylon, or when they were restored, they still were corrupt and prostituting themselves. Now, prostituting themselves just means compromising with covetousness. It's a figure of speech. Like when Israel worshipped other gods other than God, they practiced idolatry. That was called prostituting themselves or playing the whore. And it's a figure of speech. And, you know, Paul said twice in Ephesians 5:5 and Colossians 3:5 that covetousness or love of money is idolatry. It's being an idolater, which is in the Old Testament like a fornicator, spiritually speaking. So there's a number of ways that this can be looked at. The main thing it seems he's saying is that there's a judgment coming on Tyre, and it'll be a significant one. But after a period of time, 70 years, they will be restored, but they will be corrupt again. Now, and they'll make money again. Now, it's when it says their money will be given over to, the people of God. I'm not sure exactly how that's to be understood. It could be just saying in general that, like all sinful nations, this one will come to nothing, because Tyre has been destroyed. It's destroyed after the Babylonian exile by Alexander the Great in the early 4th century B.C. So it's like a couple centuries after Babylon. But to say it'd be given for food and clothing and so forth to the righteous, this could be figuratively said that, you know, all the wealth of the nations eventually will be inherited by God's people when they inherit the world. Jesus said, blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. So it's possible, it's talking about just in general, that although the wicked do become prosperous, God ultimately judges them, and eventually everything they've gained will be turned over to God's people. It's even possible that it could be talking about when Alexander the Great conquered Tyre finally, that shortly after that, he elevated the Jewish people because he was impressed by the prophecies about himself in their prophet Daniel. And he elevated the Jewish people, made them governors of his provinces and so forth. And it could be saying that, you know, what Alexander took from Tyre, much of that profit ended up in the hands of, you know, the Jews. Not all of it, certainly, but some of it could have, which seemed rather unlikely. And the prophet may mention it just as something that's something God would work out. There are definitely ambiguities in the passage. The general idea is that evil Tyre will be judged. They will apparently not learn their lesson. Once they've been judged, they'll come back to their own wickedness, but they'll be judged again, and their prophets will eventually go to the righteous. And it could be, as I say, a number of ways that could be understood. It is true, Isaiah often speaks symbolically and in poetry, so it's kind of difficult to know how to press the literal in some cases. I think this is one of those cases, but I did suggest a couple of possibilities. I'm out of time, though, for this call. I appreciate
you
calling.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for calling. We take a break at this point. We have another 30 minutes ahead. Don't go away. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, to access any of our resources for free or to donate if you wish, thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. Once again, our lines are full, but if you want to call in a few minutes, you may find a line has opened up. They do. The number to call is 844-484-5737. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith or a different viewpoint from the host you'd like to discuss, call this number, 844-484-5737. Our next caller today is Paul from Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Paul, good to hear from you again. Long time no hear.
Yes, good to talk to you again, Steve. Hope you're doing well.
Thank you. We're doing fine.
Good, good, good. I'm looking forward to you coming out this way. I know you're coming out to Winona, but that might be a little bit of a stretch.
I know, it's like a few hours from you, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, about 4 hours. But we look forward to seeing them soon some other time, I'm sure. A couple of quick questions because I know you got other people in mind. I've been listening to some assembly choir, really enjoying it. Some of the feelings I've got about the home church kind of idea, still kind of pondering it. But anyways, my question is this. Apostolic succession, is the term apostolic fathers from, I guess, in the Catholic mindset, are, you know, the apostolic fathers and bishops and popes, are they all synonymous for the same term? And my second question would be, I guess Ignatius wrote that, you know, seven letters before they're taking him to Rome to have a mark, that, you know, they should listen to the bishop. And my thought is maybe at that time, because of Spentius and some other, you know, heretical teachers, it maybe was in the mind of Ignatius saying that, you know, that possibly, you know, there could be some serious problems with, you know, just the teachings that were going around that time and the concern for that. And that's what kind of moved towards that kind of a political type of structure. Anyways, I'll let you answer those two questions. And, yeah. Anyways, take care, buddy.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Good talking to you. I'll address that. The Roman Catholics do talk about apostolic succession. And by that, they mean that when the apostles died, there was another generation of bishops waiting to kind of step into their role. And when those men died, the next generation of bishops stepped into that role and so forth. Every generation, a group of bishops stepped into the role that had been held by the apostles, so that every generation had some men who were like the apostles. And the Roman Catholic Church teaches that that's who the bishops are of the Roman Church, that the Roman Catholic Church, the bishops are the successors, going back 2,000 years, to the apostolic office, and that the Pope, who is the Bishop of Rome, is the successor to Peter himself, whom they believe had priority over all the other apostles. There's no evidence in the Bible that he did, but they believe he had priority over the other apostles, and therefore the Bishop of Rome. They say Peter was a Bishop of Rome. Again, there's no evidence in the Bible of that either. But they say Peter is the Bishop of Rome. The Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter's position. And since Peter had priority over the other apostles, the Bishop of Rome has priority over all the bishops of the church. All of this is based on several assumptions, none of which are found in the Bible, and some of which seem to be disproven in the Bible. For example, the belief that Peter was the bishop of Rome at the beginning. When Paul wrote the book of Romans, the church had been there for over a decade, and Peter was not yet there, because Peter, even after the founding of the Church of Rome, was still in Jerusalem at the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15. And when Paul wrote to the Roman church, he greeted, 20 people or more who he knew in Rome, said hello to them. He didn't even greet Peter, which would be a strange thing if Peter was, in fact, the bishop of that church. The biblical evidence is that Peter wasn't even in Rome during the time of, the book of Acts. He may have come there afterward. But he wasn't the founder of the Church of Rome, nor do we have any evidence he's the bishop of Rome. So this is the Catholic teaching. Now, who were the church fathers? Were they the same as these apostolic successors? Well, some of them probably would be, but the church fathers is a term just used for Christian leaders and spokesmen in the first few centuries after the apostles, who left something in writing for us. Some of them were bishops. You mentioned Ignatius. He was a bishop of Antioch, as I recall. And, Irenaeus was a bishop. There were several. A lot of these church fathers were bishops. But also, there were some that were not bishops. I mean, Justin Martyr was not a bishop. Tertullian was not a bishop. And so the church fathers are not principally or exclusively bishops. They were simply, defenders of the faith or, vocal spokesmen for the church in their day. Some of them held church office, some did not. And so the term church fathers is not exactly synonymous with the term apostolic successors. Some of them certainly would be probably considered to be successors in the mind of the Catholic Church. The Bible never indicates that the apostles would have any successors. And, of course, Judas hanged himself and the apostles chose a replacement for him. That's because he left office. But when James, the brother of John, was killed, another apostle, in Acts chapter 12, no one succeeded him. They didn't replace him because an apostle who dies faithful remains an apostle. His office, there's 12 foundations of the city of God, and each one has the name of one of the 12 apostles. That's a permanent structure. There's not going to be any more than 12 of those guys. And so when Judas left, he gave up his position and was replaced. So there'd be 12 again. But when James died, they didn't replace him. And certainly the church in Rome, I don't think they can identify 12 bishops that are successors of the 12 men. Just they have, hundreds of bishops, thousands probably. And so I don't know why they think that somehow makes a direct succession from the apostles. I wouldn't think so. Now, Ignatius did say that the church should submit to the bishop. And he didn't want people to baptize or get married or take communion or do almost anything without the bishop present. And you asked, is that possibly because there were some false doctrines around and the bishop had to oversee? Well, possibly so. The reason that Ignatius gave for this was that the churches tended to be divided and they needed the bishop to kind of standardize their teaching. And that probably, the division could be because of false teachers that were bringing in deviations from apostolic teaching. But it's interesting that in the days of Ignatius, which was about 115 A.D., just probably a generation after the death of the apostles, at that time, he speaks of there being a bishop of the church, whereas in the New Testament, every church had multiple bishops. They were also called elders. And the word bishop, which sounds to us like a clerical office, In the Greek, it simply means overseer. There were people who were like overseers of the church. They didn't have clerical office, as far as we know. They might have, but there's no evidence of it. They were just people who oversaw the church. They were also called elders. They were the older Christian men who were qualified to be models and teachers of the church. But there's no evidence that they held clerical titles or that the church was shaped in that way with that kind of authority. That evolved in the days of Ignatius and beyond, I'm sure. All right, we need to go back to the phones and talk to Erica from San Francisco. Erica, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for your show. I just enjoy it every day that I have to drive to work. I listen to you. I just have two simple questions. The first one is, are you going to be coming to Northern California? And the second one is, the Chase link to donate, is that more reliable than the PayPal? Because you had spoken about PayPal not giving you the donation
right.
Several weeks back. So
yeah.
I'll take it off the air. That's all
okay.
That I have to ask. Thank you for your show. And
okay.
I just pray that God bless you immensely. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. As far as the links at the website, we did have some problems with PayPal a few months back. They were, for reasons undisclosed, just decided not to give us any of the money that people were donating there. But we cleared that up. We dealt with them at some length. And now the PayPal link is at the website is working just fine now, I believe, last I heard, and for some time now. So if you're accustomed to using PayPal, feel free to use it, too, if you want to donate. But as far as me coming to Northern California, I don't have any trips to Northern California planned in the foreseeable future. I will be in Oregon, in Albany and Salem area, for about 3 days in October. I think the 20th through the 22nd of October, I'll be in Oregon. And we'll say more about that later as we get closer to that date. But I will not be in Northern California in any dates that I know of at this point. I'm going to be, of course, going eastward for about a 30-day trip. So we'll schedule something in Oregon when the flames die down, and in Northern California, Oregon, we're going before the flames die down probably. Anyway, anything I will always announce on the air, if I've got an upcoming date someplace. So thank you for asking. Let's talk to Cheryl from Orange County, California. Cheryl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have heard it often said that Jesus' ministry was 3.5 years long. Could you
yes.
walk me through the signposts that show us that timeline?
We don't actually have anywhere in the Bible that tells us exactly how long Jesus' ministry was, but 3.5 years is calculated from the fact that we know of four specific Passovers in Jesus' ministry. Let me put it this way. We know of three. We know of three Passovers in Jesus' ministry. He died on a Passover, so that that happened once a year as the Passover was yearly. So
right.
we have the Passover he died, and the Passover before that, which was a year earlier, and the Passover, another Passover earlier still, which makes at least 2 years. Now, Jesus' ministry did not begin on a Passover, but some months earlier than the first mentioned Passover, so some would say, well, we have documentation for 2.5 years. But what about the third year? Well, there's another feast in John chapter 5, verse 1, that does not say it's a Passover. But quite a lot of scholars believe it probably was a Passover. If it was, then there were four known Passovers in the ministry of Jesus. So if he began his ministry a few months before the first of them, then by the time the second one came, it had been a year and a half. The third Passover would then be 2.5 years, and the fourth Passover would be 3.5 years. Now, we don't know for sure if that John 5 feast was a Passover or not, but it could well be, and it may be even probable, though there are other feasts of the Jews that obviously it could refer to. But there's an interesting parable that Jesus told that might point to a 3.5-year ministry of Jesus. In Luke 13, verses 6 through 9. It says in Luke 13, he said, he spoke another parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came seeking fruit on it and found none. Then he said to the keeper of the vineyard, "Look, for 3 years I have come seeking fruit on this fig tree and find none. Cut it down. Why does it use up the ground?" But he answered and said to him, "Sir, let it alone this year also, until I dig around it and fertilize it. And if it bears fruit, well. If not, after that you can cut it down." Now, the fig tree and the vineyard both are common images in both the Old and the New Testament for Israel. And to find a fruitless fig tree that needs to be cut down is a not too veiled reference to the threat of God destroying Israel because of their unfruitfulness. This was discussed in many places in the Old Testament, especially Isaiah 5, but also in some of Jesus' parables, that the Israel is supposed to be bearing fruit for God, and he's not getting any fruit out of it. Eventually, he's going to just destroy it. So this parable seems to be of that ilk, that it's talking about Israel as a fruitless fig tree, and the owner, which would be God, the Father, says to the caretaker, which is Jesus, probably, the last 3 years, I've gotten nothing out of this tree. Let's just cut it down. And the caretaker says, well, let's give it just this season as well. And if it doesn't work out, then we'll give up on it. So it suggests that Jesus' ministry may have at that time been going on for 3 years trying to find fruit and get fruit from Israel. And they haven't produced any, but a portion of another year would be given to it to see how it does. And that's probably a cryptic reference to the whole time that Jesus spent trying to wring some spiritual fruit out of that apostate nation. And, there's the 3 years plus the months that he begs for. And that'd be like a 3.5 year ministry. Many people think it's referring to that. There's also, of course, the 70 weeks of Daniel. And the 70th week in particular is, like all the weeks, is 7 years long. And the Messiah in the 70th week is said to, in the midst of the week, put an end to the sacrificial system, which Jesus did when he died. And so to suggest he died in the middle of the week, that'd be roughly 3.5 years after he began that week, which was at his baptism. Now, that's a very controversial interpretation, but it's widespread. It's just not as widespread as the dispensational one. But the idea is if Jesus died in the middle of the 70th week, which is, I think, the most responsible interpretation of Daniel 9, 26 and 27, then it would be in the middle of a seven-year period, which would be roughly 3.5 years. So we got these hints. We don't have anything that specifically says Jesus' ministry was precisely 42 months or 3.5 years. But there are things in there that might point that direction. And if the unnamed feast in John 5:1 was a Passover, then that gives us approximately 3.5 years also.
Okay. That makes a whole lot of sense. Thank you, Steve.
Okay. Thank you for your call. God bless you. All right. Our next caller is Cindy from Compton, California. Hi, Cindy. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to point to our Lord and Savior Jesus, and I've always had a question about two verses, John 3:16, and then the other verse, I don't know offhand, but it says that you do well to believe, even the demons believe and tremble.
That's James
so
chapter 2.
I wanted to give you an opportunity to distinguish between the two. And I'll take my answer on off the phone.
Okay. So you're saying there's believe seems to be used in two different senses because John 3:16 says whoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. In other words, whoever believes in Jesus will be saved. And yet in James chapter 2, James is talking about people who say they have faith in Jesus. And he says, well, you say you believe in God, and that's good, but even the demons believe and tremble, he says. Indicating that, well, the way you believe may not be any better than the way the demons do, and they certainly are not saved. So the real question is, do you believe in the way that saves a person, or do you believe in a way that's not really any different than the way the demons believe? Because they certainly believe in Jesus, but they don't believe in a way that saves them. So there's clearly reference to a saving faith and to a not saving faith. In fact, that passage in James 2 begins, I think it's verse 14. I'm not looking at it right now, but he begins by saying, if a man has faith but does not have works, can faith save him? Implying, no, it cannot, because it's not the right kind of faith. It's not a saving faith. Paul also spoke about the same thing James did in Galatians 5:6. Paul said in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything at all, but a faith that works through love. So Paul says what saves a person is a faith that works through love. James said, yeah, it's got to be a faith that has that's accompanied by works. It's not a faith that is generated by works, and it's not a salvation that is the reward of works. It's salvation is the reward of faith, whoever believes in him. But it's got to be the kind of belief that changes something. The devil believes it doesn't change him. The demons believe, but they still act the same way as if they didn't believe. So, in other words, what James and Paul both say, and certainly Jesus said the same thing when he said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you don't do the things that I say? In other words, Jesus, Paul, James, you name it, anyone in the Bible who talks about the subject, indicates that though we're saved by faith, it has to be a faith that makes a difference in our lives. If it doesn't change you, then it's not the right kind of faith. The demons have a faith that doesn't change them, and it doesn't save them either. If you have a faith that doesn't change you, it won't save you either, because it's not the right species. It's not the right kind of faith. There's a lot of different kinds of believing stuff. But just believing certain facts has never saved anybody. It's trusting in God, believing, having a relationship of trust and faithfulness with God. That's what faith is. That's a saving faith, like Abraham's faith. If you read in Romans 4, at the end of the of that chapter, it talks about Abram's faith and how it totally transformed his whole life. And therefore, Paul says, and because it did, therefore, it was counted to him for righteousness. In other words, his faith was counted for righteousness because it fit the description of faith that Paul describes. And it was a life-changing faith that changed his whole direction in life, changed his whole self-definition. It changed his whole destiny. It was everything about it. Everything about him was changed. Even he left his father's home and moved to another country. His whole life was transformed by his faith in God. And he says, and therefore, it was accounted to him for righteousness. And that's not saying that you're saved because you believe and because you do things. No, you're saved because you believe. But you have to believe in such a way that's different than the way the devil believes. Or else you're no better off than the devil when it comes to salvation. Your salvation has to be like Abraham's faith, not like the devil's faith. And that's what Jesus pointed out to the Jews in John chapter 8. He said, I know you are Abraham's descendants, but if you were Abraham's true children, you would do the works of Abraham. You'd be like him. But he says, you're like your father, the devil. And so what he's saying is you can have a faith like Abraham's, in which case you're his true children. And it's what saves a person, like it saved Abraham. But if you have a different kind of life that resembles the devil's life, well, then you don't have a faith that saves. So that would be, you know, the difference in the different kinds of faith of which the Bible speaks. Carolyn from Black Diamond, Washington. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. My Bible study has just started a 5-week course with Doug Pollock, P-O-L-L-O-C-K. Two questions here. What do you know of him? And the second question, how do you look up someone and find out things about them? I went to Lighthouse Trails for a start. They have a very full, comprehensive website. Couldn't find a thing on him.
Really? What, Lighthouse Trails, is that his ministry?
No. No, I was trying to check on him.
Oh, I see. Oh, I see. So is Lighthouse Trails, is that one that kind of evaluates teachers or something?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Big time.
Oh, I wonder what they say about me. Well.
Oh, I've never looked.
It might not be good. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not familiar with him. I don't know if I've even ever heard his name, so I can't tell you what I think about him. But what I do, or what I'm trying to learn about someone, I usually don't go to these Christian cult buster type sites, because a lot of times they'll label somebody a cultist just because he doesn't hold their theology about something. And so I want to see what he has to say. You know, I want to weigh it. And so I'll look up his name online, and I'll see if there's anything that's like a bio, or if he has a ministry website where it talks about what he believes. That's where I'd look first. And, you know, if what he says seems biblical enough, or if he even disagrees with me on something but it seems harmless enough, then I don't think badly of him. But I don't know him. I don't know his name.
Okay.
I suggest you just Google him.
I hesitate to do that because I if you look up Andy Stanley, well, everything, he's a great guy, but he just went off the rails so badly and you won't
Well,
find
what you can do, what you can do when you Google somebody's name like that, you should read what they say about themselves, or what at least what favorable people say about them, and then also look at the critics, because you'll find both. I mean, that's what's going to come up. You're going to find, you know, so-and-so heretic or something, but that's by somebody who thinks he's a heretic. Read their criticisms. See if they're criticizing him on the basis of a narrow viewpoint of their own, or if he really has some dangerous doctrines. But you should also hear him, too. Remember what Nicodemus said to the Jews when they were behind Jesus' back. They were saying negative things about him. He says, does our law condemn a man before it hears what he has to say? You know? And a lot of times I've known some teachers that, you know, I didn't necessarily agree with everything they said, but I didn't think they were dangerous. I think they're relatively harmless. And yet I'll see other groups, you know, cult buster groups that just, you know, they rail him as a heretic and so forth. So I'd rather hear him and his critics. Let's hear both sides. I haven't looked him up, but you could do that.
Yeah, I will. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Carolyn, thank you for your call. God bless you. Jason from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I was wondering how you could force somebody to believe that the Bible is the Word of God.
I don't think you can force anyone to believe anything. People will not believe what they don't want to believe. You could show them... I mean, you could prove anything you want to them. If they don't want to believe it, they won't believe it. They'll explain it away. Now, if you're talking about to somebody who is objective and interested in truth, and they don't just have an axe to grind, but they really are curious to know if the Bible is credible, there's lots of things you can do. I mean, you can. There's lots of websites that have information. I have lectures on the subject of the reliability of scriptures. I talk about the archaeological evidence, the fulfillment of prophecy, the secular historians of the period who said things that were confirmatory. I mean, there's lots. All you really need to do is to research Jesus the same way you'd research any historical character and see what evidence there is for him. And then you can decide, is he someone you should believe in or not? Of course, we have to remember that the four Gospels are very strongly part of the data. We have to consider him in the Gospels. And I think a lot of skeptics, they say, well, no, I can't trust what the Gospels say because they're in the Bible. And I think, well, where else would they be? I mean, they weren't written as part of the Bible. None of the books of the Bible were written as the Bible. They are all separate books. There's like 66 books. Written separate places, separate times by different authors and floating around in circulation as individual books for hundreds of years. And then someone put them together into a collection, just like we might today if they were floating around. So, I mean, the four Gospels are not, they weren't written as part of a Bible. They were written as historical biographies by people in three cases, people who knew Jesus. And in the fourth case, which is Luke, by someone who traveled with the apostles and who knew them and interviewed them and got his information from right from the horse's mouth. So, I mean, the research into Jesus can never be considered to be objective or thorough unless it includes a consideration of what's in the Gospels. But there's lots of proofs of the Bible. I shouldn't say proofs. I should say evidences, because you can't prove anything, finally, to someone who has to make a decision of whether they're willing to follow the evidence. Unfortunately, there's a great number of skeptics who are not the least bit interested in following the evidence, but they're very interested in debunking the Bible. But if you're interested in the evidence, I have a lecture at the website. There's a series called The Authority of Scripture, and I have quite a few lectures there that show the evidence for the Bible being true. I'd suggest you go there, thenarrowpath.com. If you'd like to donate to us, we're out of time for today, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend. Let's talk again Monday.